Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me? All good? Good. How are we today? Good. Let's bow before God in a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, I pray that as I present your word this morning, as I present what amounts to the culmination of my studies over the last few weeks, I pray, Lord, that what I have studied was inspired by you, and that what comes out of my mouth is your word. I pray, Lord, also that your word will be heard today, and ask for this blessing in your son's name. Amen. This morning, as we continue and I think conclude our look at Genesis, we'll be looking at the life of Jacob a little bit more than what we did last week. I'll be focusing on the spiritual struggles that he goes through as he comes to his brother Esau 20 years after he fled for his life. We'll look at Jacob's character and how he was far from perfect. Jason brought us pretty good insight into that last week, where we had the whole outwit, outsmart, and for those fans of Survivors, what's the last one? Outplay your opponent. And, you know, we learned last week how Isaac, the father of the two sons, was tricked into giving the blessing intended for Esau, gave it to Jacob instead, and so Esau was outwitted. We'll also look at how Jacob, in his lowest moment, undergoes a life-change experience through a wrestle with God. Finally, we'll look at how God protects Jacob from Esau. We read in the passage this morning that they're very close. After 20 years, Jacob is coming back to Canaan, coming back home, and he's afraid of how his brother is going to receive him. So we'll look at all that, and we'll bring it to a close with a modern-day context. How does this apply to us? But before jumping in, I have a personal adventure that I would like to share. I've spoken with a few of you already about how every year, Karen and I, we take our family, we rent a cottage, and it's a rental cottage, so we go there every year. We spend a week playing on the beach, building sandcastles. Well, more James and Griffin build the sandcastles, but we go swimming in the lake, we go kayaking. Generally, we have lots and lots of fun. All those good cottage things. Cookouts, campfires. Generally, a good time is had by all. And over the years, it's been several years now since we rent this cottage, we've become familiar with the surroundings and familiar with, you know, what's around us. But that very first year that I went to the cottage, I hate to admit it, but I narrowly avoided a nautical disaster. So the cottage itself, it's at the top of a lake. It's a pretty small lake. It's large enough for seaplanes to come flying in, which is really cool to watch, as it is seeing them take off. But the lake's not big enough to really attract any motorboats. So it's a nice, quiet lake. And the engines on the planes, when they're taken off, they actually sound like little lawnmowers. It's really freaky. But anyway, the cottage stands right beside the inlet of the lake, and it's this fairly wide stream. I'd say about as, you know, three times as wide as the podium that I'm on. And that year, there had been a ton of rain the week before. It had rained, like, constantly for 4 days. And so all of that water was running off the hills, coming into the stream, flowing into the lake. So it was running really, really fast. In fact, the lake itself had risen to the point where we had expected there to be a beach. There was no beach. It was water. Anyway, as I was mentioning, you know, there's still lots of stuff to do. At the other end of the lake was the other stream, the outlet stream, right? In, out, that's kind of how lakes work a bit. And the owner, upon his arrival, you know, was talking about all the different things to do, and he had mentioned that if you go to the other end of the lake, there's a stream there, and if you follow that stream, you can actually follow it all the way to another lake, a much larger lake. I was very interested in trying this out. It seemed like a cool thing to do, the way he described it, kind of like, you know, it's all overgrown with woods and everything, and you have a little, you know, Amazon type of experience up near Shawinigan. Go figure. So I decided I would go and hunt out this stream and, you know, make my way to the other lake. The first time that I tried this, paddled all the way across the lake. I exaggerate, it's not a big lake, but just for the story, it felt like a big lake. It was the first time I've done it. You know that sensation you get when you're going somewhere for the first time and it just seems to be longer and longer until you finally get there? It's kind of how I felt kayaking on the lake. And much to my disappointment, I got there, and at the other end was the stream, and over the stream was a bridge. But unfortunately, the water was so high, it was only about 6-8 inches below the girders of that bridge. So in disappointment, I had to turn around, make my way all the way back to the other end of the lake, not really accomplishing what I'd set out to do. I decided, though, I still wanted to try it. So a couple of days later, after the lake level had dropped, tried it again. This time, there was about 2, maybe 3 feet of water between the water level and the girders. Now, as you can see, there's a lot more to me than 3 feet. Even sitting down, there's still, you know, a good foot and a half above. So I decided I would charge forward and try it anyway. So I leaned back, I was in the kayak, and I paddled through. Now, the lake was still pouring out tons and tons of water, right? So the current was pretty fast, and I was worried, smacking my head on the girders. That wasn't the nautical disaster. That didn't happen. What did happen, though, that I looked forward and I saw this huge tree which had fallen over and was covering halfway of the stream. And so I tried to avoid plowing into this tree, and what I did was basically lifted my paddle right up into the girders, and a second later I was underwater. Thankfully, I just, you know, scooted out of the kayak and was able to float a bit, went downstream a bit, and was able to get back into the kayak. So I'm on the other side of the bridge, and I figure, why not? I've made it past the worst, you would think. I decide I'm going to keep going. It wasn't long, however, after I start to hear this noise, and it's kind of a really low and high-pitched noise all at the same time. I thought maybe it's just some trucks passing over the bridge, but the noise was getting louder as I was getting further from the bridge, so that didn't make sense. Then I realized what I was hearing was the sound of water falling, which, if you're in a kayak in a fast-moving stream, it's a little bit of a concern. I'm going to be the first to say I'm not an expert kayaker. So somewhere at the back of my mind, I remembered a sign for a little inn that stood by a waterfall very close to where the cottage was. It was at that very moment I decided, you know what, maybe this whole thing isn't such a good idea. Maybe I don't want to get to that other lake, at least not today. But enough about that. Let's jump back to Jacob. So, you know, we've been going through a little bit about Jacob in Genesis. Last week we saw, and I think it's pretty clear, the text is pretty clear in Jacob's life that he is a man who is, I don't know, far from perfect. I'm not saying any of us are any closer to perfection than he was, but clearly he was a man far from perfect. In fact, as we see in our reading today, Jacob is returning to his homeland after having had to exile himself. He had to get out of Canaan and head on over to his mother's brother, his uncle Laban, and live there for 20 years. So, what do we know about Jacob? Well, we know he's the second of fraternal twins, his brother obviously being the older one, the firstborn. We also know that his name means literally heel catcher. When Jacob was born, or when Esau and Jacob was born, out came Esau and a hand on his foot, on his ankle. And then out came Jacob at the other end of that hem. The idea of being a heel catcher, though, it's not a small thing. It probably doesn't translate well into English and into our society. But in that day, it really did have a derogatory tone about it. It alluded to being a trickster or a con man, a scoundrel or rascal. It's by far not a compliment. So let's just think about that for a moment. Now, I have two sons. I was fortunate and blessed enough to actually see them being born. And I can say firsthand that being born is quite the ordeal. It is not easy. We know that a newborn goes through quite a lot of physical stress as they're being pushed through that canal, that birthing canal, and pushed out of it. So on top of all of that that's happening, Jacob had the tenacity and the determination to hold onto his brother's ankle, or to his heel, I should say. That must be some serious grip. And I don't know if you remember, but when my sons were born, you know, they'd wrap their hand around my little pinky, and there was nothing there. So that really says a lot about Jacob's character. It would be very safe to say, I think, that Jacob was also tenacious and determined. He was also his mother's favorite. We heard last week that Esau was Isaac's favorite, so a little bit of sibling rivalry going on in the family. But we also know that God foretold to Rebekah that two nations were in her womb. Two peoples will be separated from her body, and one people will be stronger than the other, and that the older will serve the younger. So maybe this is why Rebekah favored Jacob. She had the inside scoop. We also know he was content to stay at home among the tents. Some would say a mama's boy. I think that's what you called him last week, Jason. He hung out in the kitchen, loved to cook, that sort of thing. Not that there's anything wrong with cooking, as long as it's on a barbecue. And true to his name, he swindled his older brother out of his birthright. It wasn't just the birthright, but it was Esau's inheritance. In Hebrew tradition, in Jewish tradition, the entire inheritance is split up equally among all of the sons plus one son. And then that last son's share, which doesn't exist, is added to the firstborn's inheritance. So Esau was giving up quite a lot here. He was giving up 2/3 of the inheritance. And with the help of his mother, Rebekah, he deceived his blind and aged father. That goes back to that whole scoundrel thing. And he stole Esau's blessing from him. He had to flee from home for very obvious reasons. Esau was fed up and really, really, really wanted to kill him. There's no doubt about that. Jacob's life was in danger. So that was chapter 27, 28. And now we're in chapter 32. One of the things with Genesis is that if you skip chapters, you skip decades and maybe centuries. So you got to pay attention to all of it. There's really a lot of stuff there. In the 5 chapters, or 20 years, since chapter 27, coming to chapter 32, Jacob flees to Laban, who's Rebekah's brother, where he meets Rachel, his love of his life. In return for 7 years of service, Laban agrees to give Rachel to Laban in marriage. Laban agrees to give Rachel to Jacob in marriage. And on the wedding day, wow, Jacob the supplanter, Jacob the trickster, is himself tricked. And instead of getting Rachel, he wakes up the next morning only to find out that he is betrothed to Laban. Now, it's probably hard to relate to that, right? I mean, how can you mix one for the other? But, you know, not a lot of light, darkness, shawls, veils, all that stuff. I could see it happening. So, obviously, Jacob's frustrated. He's, how could you do this to me? He said, We don't typically marry off our daughters before we married off the firstborn. So Jacob and Laban make another agreement. For another 7 years, I'll provide service to you, and in exchange, I'll get Rachel. And so that second week, he married Rachel as well. Over the next 7 years, Jacob fathers 11 children with his two wives, Leah and Rachel, and also their maids. I won't go into all the details of the 11 children. But essentially, after fulfilling a second round of 7 years service, Jacob wants to leave Laban, but instead agrees to stay in exchange for wages. So now it's not one of his daughters, it's pay. It's something in return in material goods. And the deal that he makes with Laban is he says, you know what, I'll take the stuff of your flocks, your livestock, when they're born, if they are flawed, I'll have those instead, and you can keep the best of your crops, the clean, the pure, the white or the black, depending if you're talking about a goat or a sheep. And Laban agrees to this. Now, Jacob, if you remember, he's got to get back a little bit at Laban. So he works hard, and over the next 6 years, he manages to build a flock, a herd, a livestock that is speckled and striped and not the right color, but bigger and stronger than Laban's. And in doing so, he ends up at odds with Laban's sons. Laban's sons think Jacob has now just stolen our inheritance. All we've got are these, you know, weak flocks, which, you know, are not numerous, and look at Jacob, he's got everything. In reality, this was accomplished through God's direction in Jacob's life, showing him how to be a good livestock breeder and blessing his efforts. So at the end of 20 years, right, we've had seven and another six, we're at 20 years later, God appears to Jacob in a dream in the form of an angel. And he says to Jacob, it's time. It's time for you to go back to Canaan, back to your homeland. So because of the way that Laban's sons felt about Jacob, the hostility that was going on, Jacob determines that he is going to leave secretly and get out of Laban's hair as fast as he can. It turns out, of course, that Laban did not like this idea very much, and when he heard about it, he chased Laban and he caught up with him. And they were prepared to go to battle of some sort or another. In the end, they parted ways peacefully. They came to an agreement because God approached Laban in a dream the night before and said, you know what? Do not do anything to Jacob. So in the end, they parted peacefully, agreeing that each will go his own way, but also that they would stay separate from each other. One or the other would not enter the other's land for any type of harm towards the other party. Now, throughout these chapters, Jacob also has a few encounters with God, and I took a few, there was some sprinkled in what I just went through, but also I wanted to separate a couple out just to highlight them, because they are important. In Genesis 28, as he is escaping from Esau, so from Canaan over to Laban's home, Jacob stops to rest. Starting at verse 12 through to verse 15, so Genesis 28, 12 to 15. He had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the land on which you lie, I will give it to you and your descendants. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And then also in Genesis 32, verses 1 and 2, that's the top part of this week's chapter. Now as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. Jacob said, when he saw them, this is God's camp. So he named that place Mahanaim. In the first passage, just as Jacob is about to enter what is in effect a 20-year bondage to Laban, God affirms first and foremost to him the covenant made with Abraham, his forefather, that the land of Canaan would become his and his descendants. And this covenant now becomes Jacob's covenant. God confirms that Jacob's line holds the hope and blessing for all the earth. In other words, it is Jacob's line that will produce the Savior of the world, God made into man. And God further promises that he will protect Jacob and will remain with him until he has fulfilled this promise. So, gotta ask, is it because Jacob holds the birthright, you know, the birthright that he stole from Esau, or swindled Esau out of, that the covenant falls to Jacob? No. Not at all. In fact, if you remember, God told Rebekah, even before Jacob was born, that there would be two nations and that the younger nation would reign over, or that the older nation would serve the younger. Jacob and Rebekah, in their swindling and conniving, were merely fulfilling God's plan. As we know, when God makes a promise, he keeps it. So it should be no surprise that on his journey back to Canaan, Jacob witnesses God's camp of angels. Just as he is about to confront Esau, who 20 years earlier wanted to kill him. It's not that all of a sudden a host of angels suddenly appeared. Rather, they had been with Jacob all this time. God promised to be with Jacob no matter where he went, and the spiritual camp that Jacob was now seeing had been there all the time. It was just now that he was able to see it. It's interesting to note that Jacob's eyes were opened to God's presence shortly after his leaving of Laban. In one way, we can look at it in that Laban, being a worldly man, after so long with him and leaving him, Jacob was now starting to see that, you know, who the true God was, and his eyes were starting to be opened. We often miss out on the things God wants to provide in our lives simply because of our ties to this world. As John read earlier in this morning's passage, Jacob is extremely afraid of having to confront Esau. He sent messengers to Esau trying to convey to him that Jacob was not a threat. Look, Esau, I've got enough of my own stuff. I've got these flocks, I've got these herds, and look, all of my servants, these are mine. I have no interest in your wealth. I just want to come to make peace with you. So imagine how he must have felt when Esau's first response was that he was coming and that he was bringing 400 men with him. When Jacob had fled 20 years earlier, Rebekah had promised that it would only be for a few days and that she would send word once Esau's anger had cooled. Jacob never, ever got that word. So understandably, he moved from a position of where he was afraid to a state of great alarm. He had to take action. Jacob then does two things. Knowing that everything he has worked for in the last 20 years is at risk of annihilation, and having nothing else to go by other than the assumption that his brother still wants to kill him, he splits his camp into two so that when one is attacked by Esau, the other may escape. In this way, maybe all will not be lost. Maybe something can be saved. Then, with no other options, he's done everything he can think of to protect himself and to protect his family and his wealth. Jacob turns to God. He remembers God. Going to turn again to Genesis 28, starting at verse 9, and we'll continue to read through the end of the chapter. Genesis 28, verse 9. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, Return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all thy loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he will come and attack me and the mothers and the children. For you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. So he spent the night there. Then he selected from what he had with him as a present for his brother Esau. He selected 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels, their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He delivered them into the hand of his servant, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, Pass on before me and put a space between droves. He commanded the one in front, saying, When my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, To whom do you belong and where are you going? And to whom do these animals in front of you belong? Then you shall say, These belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, he is also behind us. Then he commanded also the second and the third, and all those who followed the drove, saying, After this manner, you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, Behold, your servant Jacob is also behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward, I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him while he himself stayed in the camp. Now he arose that night, took his two wives and two maids and his 11 children and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. And Jacob was alone, and a man wrestled him until daybreak. When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated when he wrestled him. Then he said, Let me go, for the dawn is breaking. And he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. What is your name? Jacob said to him, the angel said to him. And he said, Jacob. Well, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. And Jacob asked him and said, Please tell me your name. But he said, Why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. Jacob returned, as Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat of the sinew of the hip, which is in the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh in the sinew of the hip. So it's very interesting that in his deepest, darkest moment, all alone, after he has prayed to God, Jacob gets insight. He gets the insight to send forward an appeasement to his brother. He gets the insight to send his family across the river. Now, you might think that, well, he's only sending the appeasement because he wants to please his brother and perhaps bribe him into passivity. If that were the only thing that he had done, you could be right. But he did two things. He sent his family across the river. And in so doing so, he put that whole group at risk. For if Esau were to attack that group, then they would be immediately backed up into the river. They would have nowhere to go. And this is a sign of the faith that Jacob is starting to develop. with God's direction, he recognizes that he is tied too much to what is in this world. He is tied to his goods, his flocks, his family. And to get back to where he needs to be, he decides to be alone. So the point here is that Jacob is separating himself from his worldly self, and in so doing is trusting entirely in God that he will fulfill what he promised to Jacob. God said to Jacob, "I will keep you well." Free from the entourage of his family and servants, and having done everything humanly possible to handle the situation, Jacob is actually in a place where God can finally come and confront him. There's the old adage that there's no rest for the wicked. And likewise, there's no rest for Jacob. All alone, a man comes to wrestle him. It is already late into the night, and still Jacob is deprived of getting any sleep. The struggle continues, though, to the early morning, and seemingly, Jacob and this mysterious man are equally matched. But who is this man? We know from Hosea that Jacob did not wrestle with an ordinary man, but what Hosea calls the angel. And as the following verses show, this was another appearance of the pre-incarnate Christ in the form of a man. This man was God in human form. And it's this wrestling match between God and Jacob that represents the culmination of God's lifelong struggle with Jacob. Sorry, Jacob's lifelong struggle with God. It's the other way around. I was kind of led into that by, you know, the title of the sermon today. It's kind of backwards, and it's not just the wrestling. The wrestling is the culmination. Jacob had a lifelong struggle with God. We know that this man is a supernatural being because with a mere touch of Jacob's thigh, that thigh is dislocated. Now, Dick could correct me if I'm wrong, but the thigh is possibly the strongest joint in the whole human body. It's very, very difficult for that to get broken or dislocated. And this has a physical and a metaphorical representation. On the one hand, we all are born, we grow, we get old. Our parts break down. Our physical bodies are frail and weak. On the spiritual side, what's represented here is that Jacob has been continually struggling against God, and in fact, he's been thwarting God's efforts to bring grace to Jacob. It's when we recognize that it's by God's plan and God's strength that we can live most effectively and not by our own wits, that we also have that same representation. So Jacob's finally made aware of who he is struggling against. And he does not yield. He does not let go, though, when the man tells him to. Instead, even though he has lost, I mean, he's got a dislocated hip. So even though he's lost, he knows who he is grappling with. And having been touched by God, the only thing that Jacob can do at this point is hold on firmly to the Lord and to seek his blessing. And this was the turning point in Jacob's life. All along, he had been struggling with man, with Esau for dominance in the family, with Laban for things that were rightfully his. And in so doing so, he'd created enormous hostility against his brother, and enormous hostility against Esau. They had to come together and make a peace pact. But more importantly, at the same time, he had been struggling with God. Now that he had fully given in to trusting him, the struggle was done. Now all that he would need to do is to cling to God with the same tenacity and the same determination that he clung to Esau's heel when he was born. Jacob asks the man, "What is your name?" Several weeks back, Steve demonstrated how Abraham needed to be certain in God's covenant with him. In the same way, Jacob demands proof. Lord, I hear what you're telling me, but how do I know? And the man's answer is simple. He does not give one. He refuses to tell Jacob his name. And instead he asks, why do you ask my name? If at this point Jacob does not know who he is contending with, then in reality, he has not finished his struggle, has he? He has not fully yielded to God. Actually, Jacob does know, and this is why the question goes unanswered. We see this from the name that he gives this place where this event happened. He calls it Peniel, meaning face of God. Jacob also understands it is only by God's grace and mercy he escaped from this episode with his life. No man should be able to wrestle with God and live. But God was and is forever gracious. Chapter 33 of Genesis continues the story of Jacob and Esau. And if you read that chapter, you'll see that when they meet, Esau comes running across the fields. And Jacob is afraid because he's thinking he's running because he wants to get at me. But when they do meet, Esau embraces Jacob. From this, we see that over the last 20 years, God had in fact been working on Jacob and at the same time been working on Esau. Jacob had thought there was going to be this huge need for reconciliation, when in fact, God had already taken care of that. It's interesting that all of this came about because Jacob and Rebekah thought they had to help God, right? Jacob had to have the birthright. He had to have the blessing. We often simply mess things up when we try to help God out. That's the pure fact of it. More than likely, Jacob coming into his own would probably have been much more immediate than the 20 years of bondage that he had to go through as a servant to Laban. A simple rule that we can always live by is that God never needs us to sin to help him further his plan in our lives. And the point I'm trying to make here is that when we put our faith in God, we can always expect the unexpected. Jacob did not expect Esau to embrace him. On the contrary, being bound to our own reasoning, we fall into the trap of predicting how other people will behave and react to ourselves and our actions. Consequently, we behave in a manner that suits those assumptions. And this was basically how Jacob operated before his encounter with God. On the other hand, if we put our faith in God, we can rest assured that he will extend his grace to us. We can know that no matter what is going on around us, God always has the best in mind for us. So you may be wondering what any of this has to do with me going down that stream on the lake. Well, when I got back that day, my wife chided me. She said, you know, I did really feel foolish because she let me know that in addition to the inlet and the main outlet, there was a third stream. There was a third stream that I didn't see. And basically, I had just gone down the wrong stream. I had, you know, plowed forward. I had, you know, risked getting a good whack on the noggin. And it was all for naught. I was just completely on the wrong track. And, you know, I had to turn around, right? It's not as if there was a taxi service that was going to come pick me up. I had no cell phone or anything like that. I had to turn around, and now I had to face all of that current and all of that rushing water and go back under the bridge. I had to retract from my course of action. In the same way, when we ourselves go down the wrong path, we sometimes feel the need to try to fix things that result from our bad decision. And this is where Jacob was at. He felt he needed to fix things with his brother. The good news is that despite our going astray, despite our bad decisions, our actions can never interfere with God's divine plan for us. God is infinite in his grace, and coming back to him can only lead to good for us.